You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up after 6 tonight on 1A+, the story of art without men. Art historian Kate Hessel joins Jen White to highlight the work of women artists from the 16th century to today. Now, ever since human beings figured out there were other planets in our galaxy, some have wondered, is there life on those other planets? With the latest technology and a growing body of research, we know the answer is maybe. But our next guest says there's good news. Even if answers seem to be eternally around the corner, the search for ways to detect life in the universe tell us a lot about ourselves and the planet we live on. In her new book, she explores the worlds and science of science and science fiction, research and imagination to learn more about what makes life on Earth unique, at least so far. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What is your favorite portrayal of alien life in a science fiction book or movie? Do you think there's life on other planets? And do you have questions for our guest about the different kinds of research looking for that kind of life? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie Green's a science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you spend a lot of time talking to actual scientists in the book, but you also focus a lot on science fiction and imagination when it comes to what alien life might be. Why was that such an important factor for what you wrote?
The way that I wanted to approach things in the book was not just looking at sci-fi as imaginings and science as potential facts, but as all of this as like one big imaginative project. And so I think that like putting the science and the sci-fi together shows us all the different ways that we imagine the possibilities of life beyond Earth. And it's obvious that science fiction is imaginative, but if you look at science also, like even something as fundamental as making a hypothesis is a kind of imagination. It's about prediction and thinking, you know, what might happen. And designing an experiment requires a lot of imagination. And so I wanted to look at the different angles that we come at this question from.
But the big disconnect I see between science and science fiction is I look at a science fiction universes like those of Star Wars and Star Trek, and it's full of teeming with life. It's everywhere you look, it seems like. Every, you know, planet has some sort of trouble that Captain Kirk needs to find a way out of. So why might life be less abundant than science fiction would like to imagine?
Well, I mean, yeah, science fiction is full of life because otherwise it would be some pretty boring stories. It's like, oh, we were in a spaceship for 3 years and then we turned around and came home, which granted, there are some amazing stories that are like that too, but those are stories about people, you know. I mean, first of all, there's the fact that we haven't found anything yet, that no one has shown up on our doorstep. Of course, there are lots of reasons for that. It could be like in Star Trek, there's this rule about the prime directive. And if we haven't reached a sufficient technology level yet, everyone's just kind of going to leave us alone to find our own path. There's also the possibility that life is just pretty rare. There are scientific reasons for this. You know, it seems like life on Earth did emerge pretty quickly in terms of, you know, once the environment was what life needed, life showed up pretty quick. But that was simple life. That was simple single-celled life like bacteria. And then it took another 2 billion years, that's billion with a B, for life to evolve complexity. And I don't just mean multicellularity. I mean complexity within a cell, structures like the nucleus, which then made it possible for various reasons for life to evolve into structural complexity, into multicellular organisms with bodies and, you know, plants and animals and all of that. 2 billion years is a lot of rolling the dice and waiting for the lucky things to happen that made that possible. And the more we learn about how life figured out that kind of structural complexity, it seems like it might have been kind of a fluke.
So, Jamie, I'm curious about this running theme in your book, that even if we don't discover life outside of Earth anytime soon, it raises big questions about life here on Earth, about humanity itself, us. What are some of your favorite earthly discoveries that have come from the search for alien life?
Ooh, that's a really cool question. I can sort of answer that personally, where I set out to write a book about the search for life beyond Earth, and in the process learned a ton about life on Earth myself. You know, I came at this with more of a background in astronomy. I'm not a scientist. I'm a writer by training, but I had been writing about astronomy and exoplanets and things like that for years. Biology, on the other hand, was pretty new to me. I took it in high school, but I had never really written about it. And so in order to understand the ways we imagine life on other worlds, and in order to like figure out the right questions to ask, I had to learn about things like convergent evolution, which is the phenomenon we see on Earth that distantly related organisms often will evolve similarly, you know, whether it's the body shapes of dolphins and sharks, they found that independently, or human eyes and octopus eyes are structurally very similar and evolve totally independently. This is one of the most interesting questions in evolution. Is this convergence where separate organisms, separate branches of the tree of life come up with the same solutions to the problems of evolution, how to use light to see your environment, how to swim, how to fly. Is that the rule, or are those just interesting exceptions and evolution is really random? You know, if an ancient fish had eaten that worm instead of the other worm, everything would have turned out differently, you know? And we really don't know this. It's a huge debate in evolutionary biology. And so I think that's a really cool open question that reveals so much about life on Earth and the sort of meaning that we make of it, and is also vital to how we imagine life on other worlds, because we'd be completely unrelated. You know, a shark and a dolphin, you go far enough back, they do have a common ancestor. But me and an alien on another world, no common ancestor. Is there reason to think that they would look like us, walk like us, think like us? It all comes back to these questions of how evolution works.
Jamie Green, science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Brian and Madison, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask, so I recently read Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, which is a fantastic book. And it's all about just the main conflict is trying to learn as much as we can before time runs out. I think a more like up-to-date version of that would be the movie Arrival. The main conflict is just we don't have much time to try to figure this out. There's no actual like conflict, like space fights. So I just wanted to ask, you know, why is that construct more rare in science fiction as opposed to like your Star Wars is? And what does that say about us?
Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, that is an awesome question. And I definitely think that Arrival, or the story that it's based on, The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang, fits into that. I also think Stanislav Lem's Solaris fits into that as well, where the alien presence, the alien entity, is unknowable. And that's a big part of it. And it's about humans trying to bridge this impossible to bridge gap. And I think we don't see that very often because those stories they're not as dynamic. They're not big battle set pieces. It was an amazing fluke that Arrival was as big a hit as it was, because it's a quiet, weird movie. And in the story, you don't ever find out why the aliens came at all. They're completely opaque and unknowable, and even more so for Solaris, where no one can communicate with this alien entity. I think we want stories very often about relationships between people, whether those people are human or alien. You know, we all learn in elementary school that conflict is the foundation of narrative, and it can be person to person or person against themselves, et cetera, et cetera. These stories with an unknowable alien, it's like person against a brick wall. And that's fascinating. And it can be very poetic and very moving, but it's especially for movies. And I know there've been like multiple film adaptations of Solaris. People figure it out, but it's not the sort of traditional story, conflict-driven story arc that we're used to.
Jamie Green, our guest, and we're taking a look at life out there and life right here in our backyard. She is the author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. We'll take your calls, want to hear from you. How likely do you think it is that there is life on other planets, and how far away might it be? How about intelligent life on other planets? And do you have a favorite science fiction version of what alien life might be like? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. We continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation about the search for life outside the universe, lessons from science and science fiction, and what it tells us about what it means to be human. Jamie Green, our guest, her new book is The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Let's continue with your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Dan in La Crosse is standing by. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon. Regarding science, the American Scientific Affiliation, regarding literature, C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, regarding poetry, my poem Evolve Me Jesus, and regarding music, the Martian spaceship landed, aliens said please, take us to your Sparta butter, Westby cottage cheese, and the cheddar moon, Wisconsin cheddar moon.
Dan from La Crosse giving us a message to those and mentioning Westby, which I think it was a Wisconsin original. It reminds me of some of the songs we've sent out into space and some of the signals we've sent to try to contact any life that might be out there, Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is hot debate about whether we should be sending signals, not only listening for them. You know, since about 1960, on and off, we've been searching for radio signals that we might receive either intentionally sent or sort of overheard from other technological civilizations. But there have also been some messages sent out. Some of them were beamed radio messages, like the Arecibo message, which was sent out from the Arecibo telescope long before it unfortunately collapsed in the last couple of years. And we've also sent some physical messages, like the Voyager Golden Records. These were literal golden phonograph records, just like a message in a bottle that were stuck to the side of the Voyager probes that were launched in 1977. And this was a project overseen by Carl Sagan when NASA realized that these probes, after they completed their observational mission in the outer solar system, were just going to keep going. And so Sagan and his eventual wife, Andrian, and a small team put together this record of images, some scientific diagrams, some pictures of life on Earth, and music and whale song and greetings in 150 language. There's also a recording of a child's laughter. It was Sagan's young son, and a recording of Andrian's brainwaves while she did an hour-long meditation on the state of our planet and humanity's struggles against, you know, our violent tendencies and all the hope that she felt for us nonetheless.
Dan, if the aliens land, I'm sending them straight to you in La Crosse. Thank you for the call. Jamie Green, our guest, let's continue with your calls now. Ryan in Glendale joins us. Ryan, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a really provocative discussion. One of my favorite science fiction stories is Contact by Carl Sagan.
Yes.
And I really appreciate it because it looks at both sides of these implications of contacting other life forms, both the scientific and the faith side. And it doesn't come down on either side. It doesn't treat it as a zero-sum game. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on some of the philosophical implications of life on other planets.
Brian, thank you. And Jamie, you write about this in The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos.
Yeah, I mean, Contact is definitely Carl Sagan is obviously a huge presence in the book and an inspiration to me, and especially through Contact, because I agree, it's a fascinating imagined version of what might happen and how Sagan thought it might happen and what it might mean to humans. And it's also his way of grappling with the power that the religious right had in politics at the time, as well as our search for some sort of spiritual meaning through science. And what's fascinating to me is that at the end of the book, and this isn't really a spoiler, and also the book is very old, so I trust that I'm not ruining anything, but we get this direct proof that in a way, in the world of the book, God is real, that a message has been encoded in the digits of pi, which means that, like, there is a message in the fabric of the universe. And I actually write about this in the book, that when I encountered that, I was like, that's really weird. Sagan's been writing against the sort of, you know, religious struggle against science. And he's very much interested in looking for the numinous, the meaningful, the spiritual. But like, why would he say God is real? And I was able to talk to Andrew and his widow and collaborator on Contact and Cosmos and many other projects. And she said that it's about looking for that sense of meaning and connection that we can find through science, through understanding the universe more deeply, that it's not a religious God, it's not a human God, but it's the sense that there is something deeper than we can comprehend, but it's accessible through science and math.
Sounds like you're describing quantum physics.
Yeah, a little bit.
Rich in Two Rivers joins us next. Rich, you're on the air with Jamie Green.
Hey, Jamie, I'm interested in something I just read about recently, which is Mars was actually occupied by, it had a living biosphere, and they're picking up radio isotopes that they can't pick, you don't pick up unless there was nuclear warfare. And the next claim was they ended up going to the Earth because of the planet was destroyed.
That we are the Martians and that Mars was blown up by a nuclear war. Does this say more about us or life elsewhere outside of planet Earth, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with any sort of scientific consensus about there being proof of a past nuclear war on Mars. It sounds like, you know, some of the ways that we try to make sense of anomalous findings, you know, when we find radioisotopes that don't quite make sense, it looks like what nuclear war looks like. But there are so many chemical and geological phenomena that we don't know about yet. So this is one of those questions of imagination, that when we see something truly strange, we sort of interpret it like a mirror through the lens of our own experience. You know, so far, there has been no solid evidence of life found on Mars. There have been false alarms. There have been anomalous findings that have yet to be fully resolved. But we haven't found evidence yet. And we've found proof that there is some ice. There was probably more water in the past, which is really promising, but we haven't found anything yet.
Jamie, we have heard a lot recently about artificial intelligence, ChatGPT. How does machine intelligence play a role in our search for life elsewhere and what it says about us?
I think the way that it's going to be most useful is that these machine learning algorithms are fantastic at recognizing patterns in ways that humans can't. And so there's work being done now about using machine learning programs to sift through past SETI observations of radio signals from the cosmos in case there's a possible pattern or signal or proof of technological origin that human searching hasn't been able to find. There's also work using machine learning to figure out possible signs of life in terms of chemistry that's different from Earth's life. So even though it won't look familiar to us, machine learning can say this would be the signature of complex living chemistry in this very alien, in this very alien environment. There is also the question of if we were to find advanced aliens, would they have transcended biology to become a sort of machine intelligence, you know, whether it's that they've created machine intelligence far beyond, you know, ChatGPT, that then replaced the biological intelligence, or did they upload their consciousness into eternal machines, or are the biological aliens hanging out at home while they send their robot scouts out into the cosmos? Because, you know, robots are a lot less bothered by space travel than bodies are.
Drones.
Yeah, totally.
Jamie Green, our guest, the book, The Possibility of Life's Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Could it be possible that alien life is hiding from us? You mentioned Dyson spheres in your book, Jamie.
Yeah, so Dyson spheres are this idea that were popularized and named after the astronomer, mathematician, polymath Freeman Dyson, which actually come from a science fiction novel from 1937 called Star Maker that I love and was so glad to discover because of this. So Dyson pointed out that a very advanced civilization would need more power to fuel their technology. And the way that they might achieve this would be to get all of the energy given off by their star instead of just what lands on a planet. And to do that, you build a sphere or a spherical swarm of satellites all the way around the star to catch all of its energy. Again, this sort of, as you can tell, started in science fiction. Mm-hmm. And Dyson was just saying, this could be a thing to look for. And so sure enough, maybe a little less than 10 years ago, an astronomer at Penn State named Jason Wright said, okay, I'm going to look for it. And he did a research survey where he was looking at other galaxies, because he figured if you're powerful enough to build one Dyson sphere, you're probably powerful enough to spread throughout the galaxy and, you know, start siphoning off from a lot of stars.
Jamie, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Jamie Green, science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Coming up after the news, we talk to the author of the new book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Jeff Charlotte documents his travels across the country and around Wisconsin and finds troubling signs of support for the rise of some form of American fascism. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Rob Ferret today, you're with us on the Ideas Network. And coming up, Wisconsin looks for a path towards greater political diversity in the UW system. But first, scenes from a slow civil war. That's the subtitle of our guest's new book, The Undertow. The New York Times calls it, quote, a riveting, vividly detailed collage of political and moral derangement in America, one that horrifyingly corresponds to liberals' worst fears. It was Kyle Rittenhouse's original defense attorney who claimed that the first shot of the Second American Revolution was fired by the then 17-year-old on the streets of Kenosha in August of 2020. Others say it's actually the shot that killed Ashley Babbitt when she tried to climb through the shattered window of a barricaded door into the House Speaker's lobby on January 6, 2021. Jeff Charlotte, author of The Undertow, takes us across the country and around Wisconsin to share his experiences with the Americans who are ready to take the fight to America. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Do you have stories like our guests of people readying for battle? Do you see signs of civil unrest right now where you are? And where do you find hope for the future of our republic? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Charlotte's a journalist, English professor at Dartmouth, and author. His latest book is The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. And Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be with you. Thanks, Lee.
You were in Wisconsin last June when the Supreme Court announced their Dobbs decision, effectively overturning Roe v. Wade. What did you see when you were in our state?
You know, I was there, and a friend of a friend was actually going through IVF at that time and was actually in a fertility clinic in Wisconsin with her doctor. The doctor stepped out and got the news and came back in crying and said they'd been advised by counsel that they couldn't proceed because, of course, Wisconsin, alone amongst, you know, arguably blue states, had suddenly reverted back to possibly 1849 law. And it was so striking. And I've been writing about reporting on right-wing movements for 20 years, so I knew that they've been working toward this moment for a long time. But because I found myself in Wisconsin for other circumstances, I decided just to wander the state and talk to the people who had been dreaming of this for so long, the anti-abortion folks. They're easy to find because a lot of them fly flags, and talk to them about what they saw this as a victory of, and what is the greater battle they see it as part of.
And that greater battle you detail in your book, and you did spend a lot of time in the undertow here in Wisconsin. And one of the people that I mentioned before in our billboard was Rob Brunn, who claims to be the head of a militia in Marinette, Wisconsin. You found him because of his flags. What was it like entering into his world with four cats and a classified number of guns?
Rob Brunn, Marinette, Wisconsin. I would just stop and take photographs of flags. And there I saw he had in his window an F. Trudeau flag. I thought that was unusual for Wisconsin. I stopped to take a picture, not knowing that I had already violated by standing on the grass of his lawn, trespassing, to be fair. I had violated one of three security perimeters. And he and his family had a protocol. If it's a Fed, shoot. If it's an intruder, shoot. If it's a fool, hold your fire and see what happens. So I aced that third bar. I was definitely a fool. And they invited me in. Rob was, you know, carrying a sidearm. And I kind of think when someone with a gun invites you anywhere, that's actually an invitation you kind of have to accept. You have to show your good faith because it's already a tense moment. We walk in and there's a pool table in the middle of the room, and it's covered with AR-15s and long guns and body armor and stacks of ammo and night vision goggles and all this kind of stuff. A TV in the corner is looping his own January 6th footage that he took himself. His kids are running around. All the windows are blacked out with far right flags that "Don't Tread on Me," F. Trudeau, and the scariest of all, the all black flag of "Take No Prisoners." It means in the Civil War that folks who fly this flag see as coming, everyone who was on the other side is to be killed. It's a terrifying flag. And yet they welcomed me into their home, and I ended up spending several hours with them just learning about how that level of armament, that level of paranoia, somehow seems to them to make sense.
Well, part of this story, as you write it, Jeff Charlotte, is that Rob was in attendance at January 6th. You said he had his own footage on loop on the TV, but at the same time, he also called it a false flag event to you. How did he reconcile those two things?
I think one of the things that those outside the far right now have to recognize is that they don't have to reconcile that. And I use the F word very carefully. The F word that I can use on public radio is fascism.
Yeah.
In fact, in past books, I've argued, here's why various right-wing movements that people want to describe as fascist, they said, no, they're not fascist. That's a word with a lot of historical weight. I think the movement now is a fascist movement. It's not a fascist regime, but it's a fascist movement. And I think fascism is primarily a kind of, it's an aesthetic more than an ideology. So to charge it with hypocrisy or contradiction, not only does it matter, it almost flatters it. It is an aesthetic of transgression. I met so many people who are at January 6th who would also say it was a false flag event. It's as if they're in a state of lucid dreaming. Delusion is too soft a word because we're talking about a mass movement that has captured one of the two major political parties. But we can't simply call it as hypocrisy or contradiction and then wish it away.
In the undertow, and you write that many of us believe we're going to resist the undertow of civil war by fact-checking our way back to solid ground. Those are your words. But as you argue in the book, you can't fact-check a myth. So what's the path back to some solid ground? Do you see it from your reporting, Jeff?
In the book, the long title essay, The Undertow, is Driving West to East Following the Martyr Myth of Ashley Babbitt, the 35-year-old white woman killed on January 6th in the Capitol. She led a charge, and she was immediately sort of made into a martyr of the MAGA movement. And so I drove across the country. And I was thinking as I got home, I live in Vermont most of the time. I spent about 6 months in Wisconsin, but I live in Vermont. I was thinking about a children's book that I would read to my kids when they were little, going on a bear hunt, family, they're not really going to hunt a bear. They just want to see a bear, and they encounter every all kinds of obstacles. And in each one, there's a course. Can't go under, can't go over it, you know, a river or a muddy field, whatever it is. Just have to go through it. And I do think, I mean, as childish as that is, I don't think we can turn away. The fascist movement, or the authoritarian movement, if you prefer to call it that, is strong enough. We're going to have to go through it. The book begins and ends with hope. I understand that some may read this book as a doom scroll because there's a lot of reporting from deep in the murk of the far right. But I begin with the hope of some singers who are long forgotten. I begin with Harry Belafonte, not forgotten, just right. Lost this week at 96, but had long been smoothed over. People forgot, didn't know that he was part of the freedom struggle every one of his 96 days. And I think about that political imagination. I'm not a strategist, I'm a storyteller. I'm not the one who's going to come up with the policies that get us through this. I do think we have to draw deeply on imagination, because what I saw in Wisconsin and around the country is the far right is gripped by a very dark kind of imagination.
Well,
it really is.
Let me ask you, Jeff, where you see the line between political polarization and what you're reporting on here, people who are thinking about actual civil war?
You know, I began this reporting, the longer part of reporting for the book after January 6th. And it's funny how these terms have mutated over the course of my career writing about the right. If 10 years ago, I had come on the radio and I had said white supremacy, I know because it happened, I would have been called hysterical. Now we accept that and we acknowledge that that's a real concept. It's a real way of understanding things. I remember in 2020, after the election, some of us who covered these movements said, this is a slow moving coup. And now that's too extreme. And then comes January 6th. After that, I started to see American historians and historians. My wife is a historian. I know that they're necessarily cautious. They know that history moves slowly. Start to talk about civil war. But even then, many in the press thought, that's ridiculous. But I started going out and traveling, and everyone I spoke to in these far right circles, Trump rallies, everything else, I didn't even have to ask a question. I just had to say civil war, and they'd nod. And the difference was whether they looked forward to it or they accepted it as a sad inevitability. And now here we are at a moment when we have Trump openly nodding towards civil war rhetoric, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has effectively displaced Kevin McCarthy as the leader of the Republican Party in the House, calling for a national divorce. The language is on the table. That doesn't make it inevitable, but it means we need to contend with it.
Jeff Charlotte, English professor at Dartmouth. He writes for Vanity Fair. He's an author whose latest book is The Undertow, Scenes from a Civil War. And he's sharing with us his experiences as he sought out the people who supported the insurrection, Donald Trump, and another American revolution. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Do you know anyone like this? What questions do you have for Jeff about his experiences, especially here in Wisconsin? And where do you find hope that our republic will hold? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with journalist Jeff Charlotte, author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. His latest book is The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, and we're following his travels across the country and around Wisconsin and finding troubling signs of support for the rise of some form of American fascism. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Do you see signs of fascism where you are? Do you think fears of fascism are overblown? And what do you think about those who have lost faith in our democracy? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Philip in Fox Valley now. Philip, good afternoon. You're on the air with Jeff Charlotte.
Great spirit, guide my words, people of Wisconsin. There is no reason why we need to consider picking up arms against our neighbors, our people who we do not know at the end of the block. Civil war is not a joke. This is not the great butter battle of Dr. Seuss. These are lives we are talking about, and they have ramifications that will echo through the ages in our children's minds. And if despite all of our differences, we cannot at least agree that the safety and security of children is paramount.
Philip, thank you so much. And Jeff, it reminds me of a quote that you open your book with from Harry Belafonte. Where your anger comes from is less important than how what you do with it.
Yeah, that's a great actually connection to think about that, because of course a lot of people are angry and they have reason to be angry, for also, you know, coming from all sorts of places. But as Philip says, you know, civil war is no joke. And one of the things that was fascinating to me is traveling across the country. I saw more guns than I've seen in 20 years reporting on the right. And I'm not squeamish about guns. I'm a gun owner. I believe in responsible gun ownership. But I've never been asked to leave a church at gunpoint before. That was new. or Congresswoman Lauren Boebert's restaurant. The manager didn't draw his gun, but hovered his hand like is in the old West. And yet when people speak of civil war, you know what they speak of? They talk about movies. Because, of course, if you're born in America, that's all you know about Civil War. They've seen, remember that old 80s movie Red Dawn that remade later? Patrick Swayze leads a football team that fights the Soviets from the hills of Colorado. And every time they strike, they yell Wolverines. It's a romance. And everyone looks as good as Patrick Swayze. That's how people are imagining Civil War. And, of course, all we need to do right now, for instance, to see what war is really like, is to look at Russia and Ukraine. There's no romance in it. There's nothing but terror. I don't think we'll come to that point. I think we are already, though, in a slow civil war. There's already casualties. People who are pregnant dying for lack of reproductive rights. Waves of queer and trans kids. A suicide wave across the country. I have a non-binary child myself. They're criminalized increasingly in 20 states in the union. And every weekend, for those who follow such things, somewhere in the country, there's a line of men with AR-15s lining up outside a library or a school or a hospital. Thank God the shooting mostly hasn't started, although I include some of these mass shootings in this category. These are the simmering casualties of what I call a slow civil war. And like Philip, yeah, people, come to your senses. We can't let it get any hotter than that.
Let's continue with your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff's in Superior. Jeff, you're on the air with Jeff Charlotte.
Well, thank you. God bless you. Happy May 4th and good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion on this topic because I'm a strong believer that Wisconsin is growing more diverse. My sister actually helps teach English to the Afghan refugees who came over last year. And I believe that all of us can make a little bit of an effort to reach out to our fellow Wisconsinites, no matter what the color is or their culture, because I think the most powerful force in the universe is love. And we need to confront our fears. And if we pray, that force of inner prayer can resolve our inner conflicts. I really think we need to turn inside to our own personal powerful force of love and prayer within.
And Jeff, may the 4th be with you. But Jeff Charlotte, you attended the rally in Sacramento 6 months after January 6th, where Ashley Babbitt's mother told the crowd, quote, "Be proud of white Americans." And in that, as you detailed, there were black people and Latinos cheering her on. So how do you account for the diversity that we see in those who have supported the insurrection?
Yeah, I draw from my friend Anthea Butler, a great historian of the Black Church, you know, a book called White Evangelical Racism, in which she talks about the concept she calls the promise of whiteness. And it's something I've been observing. I've been reporting on Trump rallies since 2015 and on, and all these sort of circles and right-wing movements before. There's been a strange gravity to the right that it's able to draw a certain number of people of color into a movement that is fundamentally white supremacist. So at the Sacramento rally, the majority of the speakers were people of color. About, I don't know, a third or half the audience were people of color. When I went to a militia church in Omaha, Nebraska, this is a church that had its own militia, not the only one I've been to these days. It's a very, very diverse church. So diversity is part of the diversity alone. We don't diversify ourselves out of this trouble. no one is immune to the gravity of fascism by identity alone. And it's astonishing that folks who are really targeted frontline, people of color, queer folks, Jewish folks, are sometimes seduced by that promise of whiteness, whiteness in the broadest sense, that they can be a part of this privileged movement. And I think that's why we need, yes, work inside, work on yourself, but work outside too, just like your sister working with refugee kids. It's an all hands on deck moment. Democracy is not something we have, it's something we do, and we do need to be more engaged with it.
It's Democracy is Something We Do from our guest, Jeff Charlotte. His new book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. And we continue with your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Allison Racine joins us. Good afternoon, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I had a comment and then a question for your guest. My comment is, I think after January 6th and the tragedy there, I think people understand the chaos around that, leading up to it, after it, and understand the idea that chaos begets more chaos. And people, I think a lot of people don't want to live like that and don't want to see more death and destruction. And I'm wondering what your guest thinks about the conviction of the Proud Boys leader, Enrique Tarrio, for his crimes.
Allison, thank you for the question. Four Proud Boy members were found guilty of seditious conspiracy for their roles in January 6th today. Jeff, what's your takeaway?
That's right. I mean, I think that's good news. I think that is, look, justice system is part of doing democracy. The slow grinding work of the courts, that's part of doing democracy, holding people accountable. That's it, right? But to Allison's question, I absolutely agree. And I think an important point to always remember and never give into that nihilism is to remember that the majority of folks are not drawn into this. On the other hand, no fascist movement in history has come to power with majority support. These movements are not interested in ultimately, they may use democratic means, and many of them come to power through elections. They may use democratic means, but they're not interested in democracy. And that word you used, Allison, was so apt, chaos. One of the best-selling Trump-supporting books in the 2016 campaign and has since become sort of a little bit of a guide to understanding the Christian right embrace of Trump is called God's Chaos Candidate. The idea is that Trump brings chaos, that chaos is desirable, a wrecking ball, they call him, burn it down, as the Proud Boys called for. There are people who find comfort in chaos. They find solace in the sort of the surrealism of QAnon. And that's the threat that's out there that we need to really engage with. It's not enough for us to say, unfortunately, hey, let's all back off the chaos, because there's some people who see the chaos and say, hit the gas, let's go.
Jeff, Wisconsin Public Media has recently begun land acknowledgments for where we sit today in Wisconsin. And you use Native land, American land acknowledgments in your book as you trekked from Sacramento back to your home in Vermont. Why was this important to the story?
You know, I part of it was because I was driving east to west, and I'm from the East Coast. And so many times in my life, I have driven west. And when I was young, I had the romance of the west. I think the first time I drove west, I had Dee Brown's History of the Genocide of Indigenous People. Bury My Heart, it wounded me. But all that time when I was young, I think I thought of that as history. And it was only in Sacramento I was looking at a Vietnam memorial, and it's they have maybe one of the, I support Vietnam memorials. I'm named after my uncle who died of Agent Orange and so on. This is a very pro-war memorial to my eye. And I'm thinking about where we are in Sacramento. So I looked it up. It's a Nisenan land. Well, who are the Nisenan people? I look up Sacramento, Wikipedia, no great research. And it describes them in the past tense as if they no longer exist. So I do a little further. Well, not only do they exist, they've got a website. You yourself can see it. And I realized that the theft of the land is not some ancient history. It's, you know, our grandparents' grandparents and ongoing in some places.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm sorry we're going to have to leave it there, but I'd like to invite you back and I'd like to have this conversation further. So thank you so much for your time and your story.
Thank you, Lee.
Jeff Charlotte, journalist, English professor in Dartmouth, and author of the new book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Coming up after the news, the political bias of college campuses and what the president of the University of Wisconsin system plans to do about it. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.